And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Well, our rainy season has started. That means the fleas will flourish. They were behind the bubonic plague, of course, and have a boggling jumping skill. And think about the possum. Its playing dead ploy is actually involuntary. So joining us now is South Florida-based author Michael Largo. His forte is writing about oddities, including his last book, which talked about the weird ways people have died. His latest is The Big Bad Book of Beasts, The World's Most Curious Creatures. Welcome back to you, Michael Largo.
Well, thanks for having me.
Trip number five, you say.
Yeah, number five.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
So you chose medieval bestiaries as your inspiration. Tell us why. Tell us what they are why you wanted to emulate them.
One of the earliest books was chronicling all different animals throughout the ages. I mean, Aristotle started this. There was a book called Philosophus, which is a second century book. It was the first time that all the animals they ever knew were collected in one format. And they would collect, you know, animals that they knew, like, say, a dog, but they would also include animals from far-off places. Tales of sailors would come back of nine-headed dragons, and they would include it in the same books. They kind of went out of style, but then in about the 10th century, they became very popular again, and they were the best sellers for about 300 or 400 years. The monasteries would hand-make these bestiaries, pictures with hand-drawn pictures of animals, and they would include all these. And all of these things were together, so they would anthropomorphize most of this stuff, make animals have certain characteristics that teach lessons. So I use that as a format to try to update that into our modern times. So the book, The Big Bad Book of Beasts, contains real animals, but also some mythical and extinct. Mm-hmm. And I look at the mythical animals as what they could have been, or, you know, for now that we have technology and science to help us interpret these things.
This is a lot of information. You must have researched this for a long time.
Yeah, it was one of those projects. I was talking to Bonnie earlier that it was one of these 20-year projects that I could never actually get anybody else to get enthusiastic about, you know. So it's been an ongoing research project. And all of these small facts, there was a wonderment also in these early books that we kind of lost. So my theme was also trying to, without being a preaching way, is trying to just see the amazing characteristics that some animals that we still have with us and some of the extinct ones, what they could teach us, not in the sense of anthropomorphically if they're slothful or whatever, but what other things that they have that we still are useful for us today.
Why is a fox cunning?
Well, the fox is not, as far as one of the canine family, it's less of a pack animal than, say, the wolf or the coyote. It's more of a family unit. So they hunt in family units. So they have a little different style than, say, like the wolf would use a group attack. So their cunningness is actually a survival technique because they don't really have a lot of animal power behind them, so to speak.
Fox in the chicken house.
Right. So you've included, as you said, extinct species and existing species and mythological creatures. Right. How did you choose?
Well, I wanted to, first of all, examine the ones that were repeated in many of these bestiaries because they became, they were mostly through Europe, through England, Germany. They all had their own set. But the same animals kept appearing or creatures. And I tried to look at some of them and see where could this have come from? Now, like, say, the myth of the Cyclops, I examine that. For every book mentioned, the Cyclops, not as a human, but some kind of beast or creature. Now, what they probably were looking at, in my estimation, was that there was a miniature or a dwarf elephant living in the Mediterranean area that was quarter of the size of an African elephant. Its skull was about twice the size of a human. So when the farmers would find this skull in the field in medieval times, the trunk of the elephant would leave like a large hole, like a socket.
Right.
So when they looked at this physical evidence, what could this creature be that had one giant eye? So by looking at some of the fossils that we have now and where that myth arose, it's interesting to put those together and see where many of the other mythical beasts that were in many of these bestiaries came from or what they could have been.
Right. So let's look at some females of the animal kingdom. In which species do they rank the highest?
Females. Oh, well, I mean, the matriarch, the elephant's the matriarch, you know, she runs the show in that species. Same with the hyena. I mean, the hyena is dominant female, and she not only is it, they have even royalty, even her offspring take her place. So it's so many interesting facts about every animal, and the hyena is one of them that they, because of the particular anatomy that the female hyena has, it, many of the ancients in the ancient bestiaries thought it was the male because they couldn't assume that a female was running, you know,
right.
running the show,
right.
you know. So they assumed it was a male. And her anatomy is such that it's kind of a little strange, explained in the book, but it's female ruled. And, you know, and stuff like that, different facts. We try to compare it to us. Like, we have, you know, humans have children of multiple ages, you know, 2, 3, 5. You know, the woman can, you know, families can handle that. But most animals decided to wait until the other one was grown. Before having another child. It's only the kangaroo is the only one that has animals of different ages, of a newborn, a one-year, and a two-year-old. And inside the pouch of the kangaroo, the mother actually makes different types of milk for the different ages of the three different types of offspring she's had. So, I mean, it's those kind of amazing facts that when you start looking at, you know, we all know kangaroos, but when you look at them, it's like, wow. That's amazing stuff that nature has, come up with to help creatures survive.
Also on the female side, of course, bees and ants.
And
in the book I read that ants don't have ears or lungs, and they're completely pheromone driven.
Yeah, and one of the things, it's just amazing facts, in the old bestiaries, this is 500 years ago, they said you'd never see an ant out in the rain. So I actually did this experiment looking out. The news forecast would say sunny. I look outside, ants are gone. 15 minutes later, it's raining. So you'll never see an ant out in the rain. They're better than the we have to get them down to the meteorologist.
I guess they would drown easily, of course.
Yeah, and just amazing facts like that, where they if water does get in, they take out all their stored goods, dry them out. You know, they have a morgue. They have a, you know, it's the amount of facts once you start reading about animals and start studying them is just amazing lessons that they can teach us.
I think army ants can band together in a lump and actually float.
Yeah, and well, I mean, they're techniques of warfare. I mean, the Argentinian ant, they're warfare tactics. They encircle another colony and starve it out. They don't let them out. I mean, warfare techniques that have been studied.
Wow.
You know, there's other animals that we now looking at. You wonder why they're here. You know, it's like the mosquito, for example. The proboscis of the mosquito, the needle nose, you know, is now even being used to be in technology, is trying to imitate that as a hypodermic needle because you don't feel it. Yeah,
they have.
Yeah.
So in Japan.
Right. So all animals have something that if any of them are lost, we're losing some key of something that will teach us many, many, many things about surviving. They've been here a lot longer than we have animals.
What are the oldest species you write about?
Well, the oldest species, I mean, I have, we start with aardvarks. I mean, that was here before primates started walking upright, and it's exactly the same. When you go out to the beach, you see a jellyfish. That hasn't changed at all in 500 million years. I mean, it's a brainless, has no brain, but yet it survived. Think of the maelstrom of ecological changes that this creature has survived exactly the same,
And it didn't have to adapt? I mean, just as it is?
Well, I mean, there's 2,000 species of jellyfish. So they adapted to various, you know, within that group, but still their basic anatomy and basic form, you know, body shape, medusa, head, and other things are the same. But I find that also interesting. We talked about a mosquito. There's one that was trapped in amber 65 million years ago. That's an incredible time. Exactly the same anatomy as the one we have today. You know, so, and we, you know, as humans, we're way newcomers in the scale of life. You know, and so there's so many animals that we can learn from and how they survive.
We're speaking with Michael Largo. He's an author of several books and an editor. And the name of this book, for all ages, is The Big Bad Book of Beasts, The World's Most Curious Creatures. It's Topical Currents. Going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
If I could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be.
You know who's singing,
if
Michael?
If we could talk to the animals, learn all their languages, maybe take an animal degree. I'd study elephant and eagle, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig, and flea. I would converse in polar bear and python, and I would curse in fluent kangaroo. If people ask me, can you speak rhinoceros? I'd say, of course, can't you?
That's the great Bobby Darin, of course, Talk with the
Talk
Animals.
With the Animals.
We're visiting with Michael Largo. His book is The Big Bad Book of Beasts, The World's Most Curious Creatures. Michael, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Yeah, michaellargo.com. And Largo is spelled like Key Largo, so Michael Largo.
And, of course, we'll have links on our website to your webpage and for the book. God, I have so many questions, but you have some fascinating information about just little pigeons that we see, I mean, that are a nuisance to so many people. Tell us about them, and how do homing pigeons find their way home?
Yeah, that is something is so mysterious. I mean, pigeons in themselves, that they were used, their homing instinct is still actually a mystery to science, and there's a couple of theories of how they do it, either from everything from, you know, gauging the angle of the sun to low-frequency waves, seismic waves that are in the earth, or even quantum physics, some theories are coming up with.
Really?
In the sense that there's some kind of way of them to know where they came from. So there's still unknown why they return home, but it's just amazing how the history of this, the rock pigeon that we see in the cities, they used to live on ledges, so when you go to a city like New York that has, I don't know, I think a couple of million pigeons, almost as many as people, I wonder, like, if they look down from their buildings and wonder, like, you know, why are all these people in our spot, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
right,
you know,
right.
This is, and their techniques for, they were still used as mail carriers. I mean, that's how efficient they were in India. In India, they were used as mail carriers up to, like, 2004. They were just disbanded from mail carriers. Pigeons were still used.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Their homing instinct is still not quite understood, but they'll come back.
Michael, about a week ago, I knew you were coming on, and I was in a residential neighborhood, my neighborhood in Miami Lakes, and I saw two turkey buzzards were working over the carcass of a dead squirrel. Tell us about the unique aspects of the vultures.
Yeah, I mean, the condor, the vultures, they're really, if you want, I classify them as nature's, you know, superior sanitation crew. I mean, they're toxic waste handlers, actually. Without them, there would be a spread of disease. So they're equipped totally. Their skulls are featherless, almost as if it was a rubber mask over it, and they're able to digest, they found, you know, anthrax, botulism, I mean, everything.
No matter how fetid.
Right. I mean, so as far as their job of cleaning up, you know, in the ancient books, they used to admire the vulture, and then it's funny how animals change their, how should I say, change their reputation, you know, the stature correctly. And the vulture used to be admired, and then it became, you know, one that was associated with
death. And then Save the Condors came
along. Right, exactly. So it has a cycle like that with many animals.
What other animals give back to the environment, like vultures and, of course, bees? And
you know, well, bees, yeah. I mean, without that, we have pollination. And, you know, hummingbirds, of course, they have to pollinate. They have to pollinate almost 1,000 flowers a day in order to maintain their supercharged metabolism. So, I mean, they're master pollinators. You know, their hearts beat over 200 times a minute. You know, I mean, and then after they eat after doing this, they go into what they call almost a stupor, in the sense that each night they almost hibernate. So, I mean, that's how dramatic the hummingbird. Other animals that give back. I mean, you talk about the African elephants. Almost 80% of everything they eat is returned as waste, and that's where their migratory paths create troughs for animals to you know, gain water. And their waste is just like giant pockets of fertilizer.
And of course, we have the dung beetle.
The dung beetle. The Egypt scarab from Egypt. But that's another thing I talk about. These dung beetles also move waste, but there's such a strange creature where they roll it into a ball, and they'll travel this, you know, they're only about an inch long, 2 inches at max, but they'll make this ball out of dung, and they'll roll it maybe 3 or 4 miles in a straight line, no matter what it's over. I mean, it's just an amazing, amazing creature.
How do animals know when storms are approaching?
Well, they have. See, here's one of the things that I found that was really interesting. You know, we're as humans, we think everything comes with our senses. You know, how we interpret the world, but the animals have so many different types of ways of interpreting things. You know, from owls and bats with sonar, and even the elephants have sensors in their toenails that feel the vibration of the earth. When the tsunami happened in India a day before, everyone was watching elephants racing towards the mountains the day before it happened. So these animals have different sensory capacities that we don't have, and sometimes we don't appreciate. And that's one of the point of the books, is to try to appreciate animals for their own individuality and for their beauty.
I was in downtown Miami right before a hurricane was coming down to the station here, and I could see rats coming out of the sewers. I think they can sense barometric pressure.
Right, exactly. Barometric pressure is one of them. The ibis is the first to return after, when you know that it's not a false eye hasn't passed. That's the first bird to return. I guess so. It's a good mascot for the UM, I guess, you know, they don't give up.
Speaking of toenails, or you said the elephants sense things, tell us some scary things about cockroaches. I mean, they were bad enough.
Oh, well, but yeah. I mean, there's another one that lives for so long. I mean, they can live off the glue of a postage stamp for like 3 months. You know, I mean, they eat pretty much anything. There's even been examples of... There was a manual that I found, a marine manual from the 1700s that it was from, issued by the Navy. I think it was in like 1790. It told captains to make your sailors wear gloves because the boats were infested with cockroaches, and they loved to eat the fingernails and the eyelashes because it's creatin, which is a protein that they use to make their shell.
Keratin. Okay. Yeah.
So that's you know, that's what they eat. So they're just vectors for disease, as opposed to you know, like a mosquito that actually carries some of the parasites with them. They're just spreading it on their feet. But they're amazing. There's one case where their head was cut off and it still gave birth, you know, 2 weeks later. So, I mean, it's just a
cockroach. Speaking of that, I read in your book that a bear can deliver a cub while hibernating.
Right.
And be unconscious, essentially.
Right, be unconscious. Yeah, so this, you know, the black bear, the grizzly, the brown bear, and the polar bear, they all have different, but the brown bear is one that can deliver while it's in hibernation and wakes up and finds you know, the
bear cub. Suckling.
Right. So that's, I guess, better than an epidermic.
What about some reproduction facts and courtships? Which beasts have the longest and shortest courtships, and which animals don't need a partner to reproduce?
Okay, yeah. I guess if you really wanted to look at you know, trying always, you would look at our human comparisons. I mean, monogamy is pretty much an anomaly in the natural world. There's only about 10 species that kind of pair for life, vulture being one of them.
Oh, gorillas?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, yes and no, because they'll have a new...
Some of them fool around a little bit.
Right, yeah. So, but there are only a few that, maybe a dozen, that actually pair for life. And then it's mostly seasonal. They'll stay with the offspring for the season. So I think that's I thought that was pretty interesting. You know, like the albatross, who once, you know, the both mother and the female and the male, the parents, stay with the egg until it hatches. Then that new hatchling, once it's ready to fly, they don't breed for 10 years. So for the entire 10 years, this albatross never touches ground, never touches
ground. How does it sleep?
Well, it has a way to shut off half its brain. So half of its brain sleeps while the other half stays awake. So it's an amazing creature where 10 years does not touch any rocks until it's ready for breeding.
My.
I mean, so the sky is its bed.
So what about the courtships? Which ones have the longest and
well,
the shortest?
Well, the courtships, I mean, the different birds have different courtships, different rituals. I mean, I think the birds pretty much have it down more. All that singing that you hear in the spring, the males singing louder with among birds are trying to attract females. So the birds are kind of more specialized in the courtship than any of the other animals. I mean, of course, then there's territorial rights, the larger herd beast with antler fighting, and even with lions, they'll try to usurp the male lion, new males will come in. So that's more whoever wins that battle. That's with apes or any of the bigger cats. But still, once that happens, the female sort of rules the pack, even though there's the king lion. She's the one that decides.
But
Who will wear the hunt, who they're going to hunt. But he's supposed to eat first, but it doesn't happen all the time. But
We're almost out of time. But just tell us, other than cats and dogs, what's a good pet?
Other than that, I don't know. Cats and pets, hamsters are fun. It's an interesting story about hamsters. I mean, every hamster that's sold in America today is from a pair of a brother and sister was found in 1930. And all of them they weren't popular until the 1930s, and now there's 100 million. There's more than a million sold every year. So in the book, I kind of joke about if we tied all these hamster wheels together, we could almost power Miami, I think, by alternate energy.
Right, right.
Michael Largo, it's always good to see you.
Like the Geico thing.
Michael Largo's book is The Big Bad Book of Beasts, The World's Most Curious Creatures. Always good to see you, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Michael.
Food and Dining is next. Return, Thursday edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Ani Berman, and of course, chef, author, and syndicated columnist, my longtime friend Linda Gastenheimer joins us. And Linda, during this segment, we discuss what's necessary for a healthy diet. And Linda, you've got the microphone.
I've got it. Well, thank you very much, Joe. Well, you know, what should we be eating? And my question to all of you is, are you confused? And if you are, you're not alone, because confusion reigns. We're bombarded with all the latest information. We never know which way to turn. And that includes us journalists. There's so much information. How do we know what's real, what's not real? So I've asked our guest, Susan Finn, to help us out. She's a former president of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and that's a new name for the American Dietetic Association. So let's welcome Susan Finn. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Linda. Thank you very much. I am delighted to be here.
Great to have you with us. And also with us, our favorite wine columnist, that's Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what's in your glass today?
Well, I thought I'd talk about wine matches for big steaks and for nice, tasty rutabagas as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Okay, so Susan.
I haven't had a rutabaga.
Rutabaga.
Well, I don't think anyone has.
Susan Finn, we've mentioned confusion reigns. What should we eat? Should it be plant-based? Should it be gluten-free? How about animal proteins? Help us out. Why is there so much confusion?
Well, let me give you my opinion. And everybody has an opinion on this, Linda. But it seems to me, and authorities in the field of nutrition science kind of come to this agreement that people think it's an easy science. It's not. When you start to really study, do research, it's complicated. Food's, you know, pervasive. It works in the whole body, and it's not like a drug. It's a food. And it's very hard to study. So that's one reason. I think the other reason is we just have so many viewpoints, and it's hard to change people's views on things. People have a fear, or they have a nostalgia, or they have a viewpoint, and we've got one study after another that kind of can support what you want. Now, luckily, the body's pretty forgiving, and I believe that the most important thing is to have a variety of foods. I'm very much supportive of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics position. You eat a variety of things, and you really balance your diet with fruits and vegetables. Clearly, I believe protein sources of all sources are very important, including animal protein, dairy. I think all of those things play a role.
What about people who have ethical problems?
Well,
that?
I think, you know, that's people that have religious reasons, people that choose to be vegetarian, and you know there's a whole range of those degree of vegetarianism, from a vegan, what is it, Mark Bittman calls it, the flexitarian. I mean, it's all, and all you can do all of those things if that is your choice.
No, but here's the situation. We've all been told vitamins are important,
mm-hmm.
And so I mean, for example, you know, when you talk about animal proteins, let's also mention that includes eggs, milk, and cheese, not
correct.
Just meat.
Correct.
So, for example, if we wanted to have B12, it's an important vitamin. First, tell us why is it important, and how can we get it if we're vegetarian?
Well, you know, first of all, B12 is important, and we're beginning to recognize, particularly in older people. We make vitamin B12. We make it in our digestive system, and there are some good food sources, but the best food source is red meat. Beef is particularly good in it. You get it fortified in different cereals and grains. So you can get it a variety of ways. The best food source is probable animal protein. But if you go back to the confusion piece, Linda, this is a good example where we have different viewpoints. And it's important that we look at the value of what you're eating, the foods of what you're eating, and kind of balance all those together. I think just reading.
Let me just ask you back
sure.
to B12 because it's so
sure.
important, and you say we need to have an animal protein for mm-hmm. it. But what if you're vegetarian? How can you get your B12
or vegan?
Primarily,
or vegan,
vegetarians
yes.
are going to get through supplementation or fortified foods. Cereals probably fortify, most of them fortify those today with B12.
Well, let me ask you a question mm-hmm. about that, because I looked at my cereal box this morning.
Yes.
And it says 100% of my B12 is there. Mm-hmm. But then I've been told that when you have a fortified, for example, a cereal, it's
so what kind of cereal
sprayed,
was that?
It's sprayed on. And well, this doesn't really matter. You can look at your cereal boxes. But mm-hmm. what I wanted to say is that it's sprayed on. The B12. Mm-hmm. So if it goes into
were you
milk,
talking about Cheerios or something?
Well, you know, fortification obviously is what's done in grains in order to make up for those vitamins and minerals, and that's fine. I mean, I'm not opposed to that at all. But when you really talk about feeding people, and particularly in developing countries where I do a lot of particular education. You have people that are really on very focused diets. They're very limited in terms of the variety of foods, and it's important that you get the kind of foods they need in order to build muscle and in order to provide those vitamins and minerals. Iron would be another one, Linda, that would be very high on the list. Yes, you have iron-fortified products, and that's good. Cereals are another example
of
that.
But my question was, do these fortified products have the same, are they just as good, mm-hmm. efficacy as the others?
They're certainly a good alternative. I mean, are you absorbing every bit of it? No. But that's one of the reasons the requirements are, the government dietary allowances groups put those pretty high, Institute of Medicine, they put them pretty high because you don't absorb all of those.
I was a little surprised to find that oatmeal, which I always considered to be so healthy, is not fortified in most cases. I didn't know that.
Well, you have some fortification. I think there's some iron in it, but, you know, fiber binds iron. And the point is that if you took every individual food and started to analyze it, you'd begin to find this confusion surrounding it. And so that's why, as nutrition professionals, we really try to recommend to people focus on food. They have a balance of food, and where possible, they eat the whole foods, and where not, due to reasons of religion or preference, then they use more fortified foods.
So,
what about vitamin pills?
Well, they're obviously they're an alternative as well. They fill in what we call those shortfall nutrients. There's a few shortfall nutrients we in the United States have. One of them's iron. One of them is B12. One of them's zinc. And those often, if people are on very limited diets and very focused on only a few things, then those things are really important to supplement. Again, you can get them through good protein sources. You can get them through many of the animal protein sources as well.
What about,
you can get them through variety.
What about the protein sources for vegans or vegetarians, mm-hmm. but especially vegans, I'm thinking, mm-hmm. that don't eat dairy, mm-hmm. tofu and seitan and those? Do those carry a lot of these
some
nutrients?
Some of them do. Some of them, is this Bonnie?
Yes.
Some of them do and some of them don't. And I think when you start dealing with vegetarians or any alteration in other than a straight diet, you begin to see, take some knowledge of how to combine those, you know, and so you have to know what you're doing as you put these things together. Can you be healthy eating that? Sure. That's
okay.
Your choice. You absolutely can. But it takes some skill. And usually people that have that interest know how to match up things pretty well.
Right. And so where does Marmite fall into this? Because I remember we lived in London, and mm-hmm. during the war, Marmite was very, very important because they didn't have a lot of animal protein then, and it still is today. I mean, for tea, the children have Marmite on toast. It's a yeast.
Very tasty, too, right?
Yeah, there you go.
You know what
Thank you.
You have, too? You have a study after study will tell us that there's things people value, and when it comes to food, they value taste. We, as dietitians and nutritionists, can talk all we want about nutrition, and we think it's very important, and it is. But taste is number one. And then it's nutrition and cost later on down the list. But taste is absolutely important. And I think as you begin to look at societies moving and advancing, if you look around the world, as societies go from a poor country to more of a middle class, which is happening around the world, their choices of tasty foods, particularly animal-based foods, goes up. And that's been true for eons of years. It just happens. And so, again, you want to help people and educate people about the things they need in the diet and the things that are perhaps missing in their diet. And right. One of them is B12, one of them is iron, one of them is zinc. And some of these micronutrients, we're learning more and more how important they are.
And those that you mentioned are what you call micronutrients.
Right.
We're just going to take a short break
here.
I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest is Susan Finn. We're talking about a healthy food plan. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and my guest is Susan Finn. She's the former president of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and that's a new name for the American Dietetic Association. And she's been helping us sort through the confusion of what should we eat, how to decide what's best for each one of us. We're all individuals, and we all have different needs. But if you have a need for dinner, it's dinner in minutes time. And tonight, dinner is going to be a Chilean salmon with quinoa and corn salad. So salmon and corn and quinoa are all ingredients in Chilean cuisine. And quinoa is an ancient grain, and it's easily now available in our supermarkets. Bonnie's shaking her head.
That's right.
And it's considered a super crop because it has more protein than other grains, and it's also a good source of fiber. So that's something to add to your little repertoire. And it's really, really easy. So make the salad first and cook the quinoa in the saucepan, almost like you're cooking pasta. And I add to it some frozen corn kernels and some lima beans that are frozen. And you cook it about 10 minutes. And then you drain it and you toss it with a little vinaigrette dressing and serve it over maybe a bed of fresh spinach. It'd be very pretty colorful that way. And for the salmon, just saute some salmon fillets about 4 minutes aside, or until it's no longer translucent. Don't overcook it because it'll still cook a little bit when you take it off the heat.
Do you put that in olive oil?
You can cook it in olive oil, or you can use a nonstick pan if you want to cut back on the olive oil. Just spray it with a little of olive oil. Serve the salmon over the salad. Now, this whole meal is 518 calories, with 31% of those calories from fat, and those including good fats. So we're doing healthy eating today. That's a healthy meal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Susan. She's
Sounds
cooperating.
Delicious.
Yep, really delicious. If you want that recipe and a photo, that's at dinnerinminute.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I know I'm always talking about big red steaks and big red wine and that kind of thing, just as Joe was always talking about gravy and sausage.
And pork. All forms
and,
of
and
pork.
And pork. Yeah, and not talking about turkey sausage either.
It depends on how much you eat, you know.
Yeah, but I've been on Weight Watchers for a while now, and I've come to appreciate a mostly vegetarian diet, although with the occasional prime rib steak
as
well.
Yeah, my guess is it's probably portions.
That's an end moderation, which
yeah,
I hate moderation.
Of course, that's a good program.
You hate moderation? Okay, good.
Because everybody's mother tells them moderation, and anyway, so obviously we need wine matches for both meat and veggies. Mm-hmm. And now it's easy to pair wines with meat. Just picture a charcoal New York strip with a bottle of California Cabernet, or a New England lobster pot pie with a $200 white Burgundy, or even a plate of raw oysters with the light as air, dry as bone French white wine called Muscadet. But these pairings aren't perfect just because of flavors. With any meat, you also get fat, of course, which can clog your arteries. But now all the top medical schools are doing studies that say that wine makes the platelets in your blood slipperier, so they're less likely to clog your arteries. Mm-hmm. Talk about a win-win situation.
And don't forget we have lean meat as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's all bred so much leaner.
Pairing wine with veggies can be done as well. I've been doing some practice on this recently, and some time ago, actually, I wrote a page of pairings for Linda's book, Vegetarian Dinner in Minutes. Remember that, Linda?
Yeah, and you said to me, Linda, I want to write some wine suggestions for the vegetarians. I said for the Vegetarian Dinner in Minutes, and I said, can you have wine with vegetables? And you said, sure.
Absolutely. There are a few principles involved. If you have vegetable dishes with creamy cheese sauces, you can go with a rich white wine like a California Chardonnay or maybe some of the new Sauvignon Blanc Semillon blends coming in now from Australia or South Africa. And green veggies like broccoli and Brussels sprouts, kale, chard, that sort of thing, that if they're simply steamed with a touch of oil, are great with a white Sauvignon Blanc, which actually has the same herbal qualities as the food, so it goes very nicely. And at the beginning of the show, I talked about rutabagas, so I better come up with a match for that.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah, I'm sure you were interested, Joe.
Oh, yeah. As long as it's
anyway,
accompanied.
Rutabagas are kind of sweet, so a nice late harvest or lightly sweet Riesling would be a perfect match for that.
How about something like Brussels sprouts?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's good for you, Joe, you know.
I love them.
And roast them.
When he wants to know what to drink with them.
And add a little onion and garlic and roast them, and you've got something wonderful. So anyway, it turns out, as I've always said, that there is order in the universe, and there's a tasty wine mash for just about anything.
All right. There you go. All right. So let's go on with a couple of things. You know, I remember cooking icon Julia Child. Mm-hmm. She lived into her 90s, and she said that it's really a shame that we have fear of food. We're afraid to eat.
That's right.
How can we overcome this?
Well, you know, Linda, that's exactly true. I mean, there is a fear, and people get on the Internet, they look at every little morsel of something, and then they get afraid. And that's true of many things. And I'm sure it drives the healthcare community nuts, and it certainly is something that registered dietitians struggle with all the time. We need to make sure that people don't get fearful of this thing. We have a very safe food supply in this country. Health is extremely important to people today, and it relates to our physical and mental well-being, and it is about variety and balance in the diet. We've gone back to something simpler as the government's My Plate is devised. It looks pretty much like the old Basic Four with a little bit more emphasis on fruits and vegetables and more emphasis on protein as opposed to meat, fish, and dairy. So it's changed around a little bit, but it's the principle of that variety.
Right. Well, I want to talk a little bit because I've been doing a lot of career days at schools and stuff and talking to the children and all. And what about babies and young children growing up on fast food and sugary sodas? I showed the class a 12-ounce bottle of Coca-Cola, and over a third of that was filled with sugar.
Well, and there's no doubt. I mean, we need to start children early to have healthy habits, and that begins at home. I mean, when a baby's born, what do they talk about now in the literature, the first 1,000 days? That's when the health status of a child is pretty much set, and that's from conception, from pregnancy, all the way through the first 2 years of life. That's why in other countries you see such an emphasis on paying attention to health and nutritional status of patients and moms and young children. In this country, where we are developed and are much more prosperous, it is not dissimilar in that we want to start children out with a healthy start. And moms and young children need to be eating healthy. They need to be eating a variety of those foods. And yes, Linda, sometimes little things make a big difference. Sometimes combining things, you can take an egg a day, and that can give a half of the child's protein needs and a good bit of the iron needs. I mean, sometimes little things make a difference. You can combine, you know, a 100 grams, which is about 3 ounces. You know what that looks like. That's pretty small. A little bit of chicken or pork or beef.
Well, we always say that's like a deck of cards, a little smaller than a deck of cards.
Yeah, it is. And we need to teach people those portions. But also start them out young with a variety of things. I think all of us as nutrition professionals don't like to see high sugar consumption in children. I mean,
What I wanted to ask you is that with so many children having these fast foods and all and the sugary sodas and all of that, does it affect their growth?
Well, I think it does. I think, first of all, we have an obesity epidemic in this country. And so what we have to say and start out is teaching children early on by example first of what's a balanced diet. And you just gave a good example. I just gave you some examples with an egg or with a combination rice dish and some animal protein. All these vegetables and fruits that are coming into season, we need to teach them. Exactly, need to teach them how to eat by example.
Right. So if we keep talking about balance. Mm-hmm. What is balance? Yeah. What does that really mean? So what's a reference point that people can use if they want to balance whether they're gluten-free or vegetarian or animal products? Right. Where can they go for help?
Well, there are a couple of very good places to go. The first place I'd go would be to eatright.org, which is the Dietitians American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics website. They have a consumer site, and it's excellent. And it has a great deal of emphasis on balanced foods. And it also connects you with a registered dietitian. You have in Miami a wonderful dietitian that does a column for the Miami Herald, Shea Rebeck, and she's excellent. And
right.
She is a very good source for that in the Florida area.
Right. Well, this has been really, really wonderful, fascinating information. Bonnie's nodding her head. It's really interesting. Thank you so much, Susan Finn, for your very valuable information.
It is my pleasure.
Okay. And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe and Bonnie, nice to be with you. Well, next week we're going to talk about staycations, how to vacation here in our own paradise, with Andrew Pittard from the Delano Hotel. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical supervision from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Thanks also to Michael Stock today. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information at the Topical Currents website, including author and book links, discussions, and more. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's Ed Bell on the South Florida Arts Beat, one of his patented in-studio live concerts. Monday, we return with Watchdog Report publisher Dan Ricker on South Florida government and politics. Now the calendar. On this day in 1919, 94 years ago, the birth of Walter Valentino Liberace in Wisconsin. He memorized difficult piano works at age 7. He played with the Chicago Symphony at 20, and of course was highly popular and certainly flamboyant for decades. He died in 1987. There's a Liberace Museum in Las Vegas. And on this day in 1955, 58 years ago, the death of writer and critic James Agee. He won a posthumous 1958 Pulitzer Prize for his biographical work, A Death in the Family. One more while we remember Kermit, the Muppet alter ego. On this day, 1990, 23 years ago, the death of puppet innovator Jim Henson at age 53. Bowing to his wishes, no one was allowed to wear black at his funeral, and it ended with an orchestra playing When the Saints Go Marching In. We leave with James Agee. We are now talking of summer evenings in Knoxville, Tennessee, in the time that I lived there so successfully disguised to myself as a child. Joseph Cooper here for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Next, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.